Y'all in the back, is everything all right?
I'll speak loudly, but this is just in case somebody needs to hear something. I would ask that in the course of the time that we have, if you have any questions, to wait until afterwards. If there's a clarification that you need, if I spoke too quickly or there's something you didn't quite understand, I'll be happy to clarify that. But I'll offer some time after we're done for questions, because some people may want to stay for questions, others may not. So we'll kind of do that. So if you don't mind, just me write your questions down as we go along. If you go to the Holy Land, or if you go to any predominantly Muslim country, or happen to pass by a mosque, which is the place of worship of Muslims, instead of hearing church bells, you're going to hear this. And this you're going to hear five times a day, every day, at dawn, at mid-morning, at noon, mid-afternoon, and at dusk. Now, the question is, I guess first one is, okay, Father, why do you have that? Right. This is just a collection of different chants and religious songs from different religions throughout the world, just because I'm kind of crazy like that. But most importantly, why did I play this? And what do the words mean? First of all, he says, Allahu Akbar, which means in Arabic, God is great, God is great. I declare there is only one God who is God, and Muhammad is the prophet of God. Come to prayer, come to good work, God is great, God is great. And it's kind of repeated over and over again in this very Arabic sort of way, which is kind of foreign to Western ears. But this is what's done in all Muslim countries everywhere. Interesting thing is that a lot of what you're going to see in Islam was borrowed from both Judaism and Christianity. So who was Muhammad? Where did he come from? Where did he get all this? And how is it that Islam was born? Well, first of all, you have some papers that I gave you. You have a timeline of Islam. And the start of the Muslim faith begins in our year, in Western years, in 610, following the first revelation to, as he is called in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad at the age of 40. He and his followers spread the teachings of Islam throughout the Arabian Peninsula. But Muhammad was born in the year 570 of the Christian era, born in the city called Mecca from a noble family, and is well known for his honesty and his upright character. He came from a family of merchants. The city that he was born in was at the crossroads between the eastern and the western worlds. Right? You have the whole Mediterranean area. You've got toward the east of it what is Egypt, and then, of course, what is Palestine, or what we would call the Holy Land today, and to the east of that you have Saudi Arabia. So it's the crossroads of the Far East and of the West itself, and they are very important people as far as commerce is concerned. But the place where Islam had its beginnings, the Arabian Peninsula, is a very arid region populated by some nomadic tribes, people called the Bedouins. You may have seen pictures of these Bedouins, people who live in these tents, have large families, will raise sheep, and so on. And to the north were Arab kingdoms that had contacts with the two major empires of the time. That is, the Roman Empire of the East, the Byzantine Empire, which by this time is Christian, and the Persian Empire, okay, which was not. To the south were other centers of ancient Arab civilizations in what we call Yemen today. And the peninsula was dotted with growing urban centers and different little oases, not just a desert, but places that were actually lush and growing. But it was a center for the caravan trade. It had different caravan trade routes that would crisscross throughout the peninsula. And the city of Mecca was significant as an important trading center. It also had a religious sanctuary called the Kaaba. Okay, you probably look, if you look on the glossary that I gave you. First you have a timeline, and then you have the beliefs and daily practices of Muslims, but the last ones, as far as the Muslim faith is concerned. Well, shoot, the Kaaba's not in there. You've probably seen pictures, though, and I'll show you a picture of it. It's a large square building, like a big block that's covered with a black cloth on which are embroidered the words of some of the words of the Quran. Can you all see somewhat? Right. This was a shrine to the different gods, goddesses, and deities of the Arabic people. They were polytheistic, meaning, of course, that they believed in more than one god. Muhammad was left as an orphan. He was raised by his uncle, okay, who also was a merchant. Kind of a solitary person, very quiet, very contemplative kind of person, but was also very astute, very good at what he did in his trade. Eventually, he would get married to a woman who was about 12 years older than himself, and in their marriage, he began to get more and more withdrawn. In that, he would go off to a mountain, and he would pray. He was searching for something. Muhammad, being a merchant, came into contact with people from practically all over the known world at the time, and many different religions. He came into contact with Jews. He came into contact with Christians. Many of the Christians he came into contact with were people that we would call today heretics, right? I mean, they were out there that far away because they had a distorted understanding of Christianity, which we're going to talk about when we talk about the Islamic view of Jesus, right? And the Christian heresies that they come from. But more than anything else, Muhammad, being a very good financier, wanted a way that was going to unite all the disparate tribes of Arabia. Why? Because these nomadic peoples would many times attack the caravans. Attacking caravans is going to disrupt trade. And when you look at it, money is a very good reason for doing almost anything. I'm not going to say that's not the only reason that he did this, but it certainly was very helpful. If he could find a way to unite all the different warring tribes of the Arabian Peninsula to make it safer for trade, he would do that. Maybe that's why he went to the mountain to think and to pray. And he came up with something interesting. He knew that even though there were certain teachings that weren't always in agreement in Christianity, the Christians were pretty much a united people because of their common faith. The empires of the East and West and Rome had a united faith, had a common faith that united the empires. And the same thing with the Jews, who, even though scattered throughout the world, had this one faith in one God. And he thought, well, maybe that's the ticket. If we keep believing in all these different gods and goddesses, we're going to stay a divided people. But if we believe only in one God, that might unite us. So this is the beginning of what we call Islam, which means submission. Submission to Allah. Allah, which is simply the Arabic word for God, right? We have different words for God in Hebrew. Yahweh is the one that we're most commonly familiar with. God is also known as Adonai, which means the Lord, or El. Okay, it just simply means the Lord. And this is where the derivative comes from. So Muhammad's going to put all these different things together and weave different traditions of his own culture, as well as stories handed over from Judaism and stories handed over from Christianity, and put them together into a book. It's called the Quran. The Quran in Arabic simply means recitation. He says that these words were recited to him, revealed to him by the angel Gabriel, and is like the definitive word of God. According to Muhammad, though, this is not a new religion, it's simply the perfection of religion. That God over time had a successive number of prophets, beginning with Adam, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, even Jesus himself, not the Son of God, according to Muhammad, but a prophet, and now finally himself, the last of the prophets, to unite all people together under one faith and one God. Right? That's the idea that we find in Islam. So it's submission to God, and this is the final revelation given by God to Muhammad to unite all of humanity. That it's submission to the one God who is Allah, and that we are going to be the people of Allah with Muhammad alone as the prophet. So let's go back to our guideline, our timeline. So according to Muslim belief, at about the age 40, Muhammad is visited by the angel Gabriel while on retreat in a cave near Mecca. The angel recites to him the first revelations of the Quran and informs him that he is God's prophet. Later, Muhammad is told to call his people to worship the one God, but they reacted with hostility and began to persecute him and his followers. In the Kaaba in Mecca were different idols, different statues of different deities. And of course, Muhammad and his followers go in and want to purify that. But their thinking is, if you disrupt the gods and goddesses, they're going to be upset with us. Now, also in the Kaaba is a stone that supposedly has something to do with Abraham's sacrifice with Isaac, by the way. It's supposed to be something very sacred in there. Not Isaac, excuse me, but Ishmael. Okay, Ishmael, I have to get back to that. But anyway, these people reject that. So after enduring persecution in Mecca, he and his followers then migrate to the nearby town of Yathrib. Yathrib will later be known as Medina, where the people there accepted Islam. This marks a very important thing. You can underline that. The Hijra. The Hijra, or the immigration, which is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. So their year and our year are not going to correspond. Important watershed moment for the early Muslims and for all Muslims today. So there in Medina, Muhammad establishes an Islamic state based on the laws revealed in the Quran and the inspired guidance coming to him from God. Eventually, he begins to invite other tribes and nations to Islam. 8 years after that, in the year 630, Muhammad returned to Mecca with a large number of his followers. He enters the city peacefully, and eventually all of its citizens will accept Islam. The prophet then clears the idols and the images out of the Kaaba, and he rededicates it to the worship of God alone. In the year 633, Muhammad died after prolonged illness. The Muslim community then elects his father-in-law, a close associate, Abu Bakr, as caliph, or successor. You can underline that word caliph, because you've probably seen in the news the word caliphate. Okay? A caliphate is something that is ruled by a caliph, okay? Which means that he is a leader or an Islamic ruler. Islam then begins to go out into Palestine, Lebanon, and to Iraq. In 641, Muslims enter Egypt and rout the Byzantine army. Muslims consider their conquest as the liberation of a subjugated people, since in most instances they were under oppressive rule. I want you to remember that at this time, Egypt is a Christian nation, by the way. Okay? Egypt is a Christian nation. All of North Africa is Christian by this time. Okay? We're talking about the era after St. Augustine, after St. Benedict, after St. Gregory the Great, who ruled as Pope from 590 to 604. Okay, so this is the beginning of the early Middle Ages, and they begin to spread throughout North Africa. So by the time that Muhammad would have been 100 years old, you have a Muslim continent, practically, that stretches from Saudi Arabia all throughout the Arabian Peninsula, going westward toward Africa, and even making its way in the east. And here's how fast it spreads. In 661, Imam Ali is killed, bringing an end to the rule of the four righteous caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. And this marks the beginning of another rule. So this is going to begin a split, too, by the way, in the two sects, I don't want to say sects of Islam, but the two philosophies of Islam that we see in the news today, the Shiites and the Sunnis, that we hear so much about in the news. In the year 711, Muslims enter Spain in the west and India in the east. Eventually, almost the entire Iberian Peninsula is under Islamic control. And we're talking about what is today Spain and Portugal. Okay, it's going to be dominated by Muslims until the year 1492. Okay? 1492 is the year that the last of the Muslims has been taken out in Granada under Kings Ferdinand and Isabella. And what did they do to celebrate after that? Exactly, St. Columbus on a voyage. Okay? Same year, 1492. But in the year 732, they're coming from Spain into Europe, but they're defeated at Poitiers. That's in central France, by the way. So they're really coming up into Europe by Charles Martel. If anybody here has a relative with the last name of Martel, and they had some Martels over in Eunice. Okay, that's your family. So you can be proud. So this is just to show how quickly Islam has spread. Why? Two things. A, the simplicity of the religion. Okay. Unlike the complex creeds that Christianity has had and the fights we had over what to go in the creed and what not to put in the creed of Islam is simple. I declare there is only one God, who is Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of God. That's it. That's it. But I'll tell you a little something about what Muhammad saw. And this might even alleviate some fears that we have that keep coming from our modern media. This is coming from the Quran itself. The Quran is divided into chapters called surahs, S-U-R-A-H, surah. And the surahs are divided into verses, much like our Bible is. But it's not written in any chronological way. It's written from the longest to the shortest. But this is from surah number 5, surah 5, verse 82. Certainly, you will find the most violent of people in enmity for those who believe to be the Jews and those who are polytheists. So, the most violent of their enemies, of Muslims, are the Jews and those who worship more than one God. And you will certainly find the nearest in friendship to those who believe, the nearest in friendship to Muslims, to be those who say, we are Christians. Interesting, isn't it? This is because there are priests and monks among them, and because they do not behave proudly. So, it's interesting. When Christians actually behave like Christians, it's not a bad thing. In the eyes of Muslims. That's something for us to keep in mind. Okay, so the question is, why the Jews? Why the Jews? Remember that Judaism traced their ancestry back to whom? To Abraham, right? Abraham, whom God had called, okay, from Ur in the Chaldees, which is in present-day Iraq, to become the father of many nations. Abraham is old, and so is his wife. She's past childbearing years. So the question is, how is this going to happen? Abraham goes back and tells his wife. She laughs, and she says, well, I can't do anything, but I will give you permission to lay with our slave girl, Hagar, and she can bear you a son, which is exactly what he does. And that son is named Ishmael, who is born of the flesh. But Isaac is born by an act of a miracle, right? By the hand of God. And, of course, the name Isaac in Hebrew means laughter, because Sarah laughed when Abraham told her that. But again, we have God promising a certain piece of land, a great land, which we know as the Holy Land, to Abraham and his descendants. Right? This is the promised land. Muslims trace their ancestor, Arabs do, to Ishmael, okay, the son of Abraham through Hagar. The Jews will trace their ancestry back to whom? Through Isaac. All right. So this land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants is being quarreled over by the descendants of Abraham, of Isaac and Ishmael. So when you wonder what's going on in Palestine, this is what's happening. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit to let you know what happens as far as Israel itself is concerned. 40 years after the ascension of Jesus into heaven, in the year 70 AD, after a series of unsuccessful revolts of the Jewish people against the Romans, Rome had finally had enough of it. So what happens is they crush the city of Jerusalem and level it to the ground. They destroyed the temple, and they forced the Jewish people out in what's called a diaspora, right? So they were scattered to the four corners of the Roman Empire. Okay, that gave this area to be in the hands of just a few Palestinian Christians and others like these polytheists. Eventually, and this is going to be important for the next talk that you're going to have on the Crusades. Islam is going to come and convert many of the Arabs, and many others are going to come and be transplanted into this area that once belonged to the Jews. And since they knew of the story of Abraham and Ishmael and Isaac and everything else, they claimed this as their own. It was the Romans who named it Palestine as an insult to the Jews. Because if you remember, who were the people that the Jews had to conquer when the Israelites, it was the Palestinians, or the Canaanites, or the Palestinians, the Philistines, okay? So it was named after them. The Romans had even renamed Jerusalem. They called it Aelia Capitolina. They gave it a Latin name as the final insult. Okay? So what you have then is from the year 70 AD until 1947 with the creation of the State of Israel, right? This land was kind of like a no man's land. Okay? And it passed from different hands. Okay, first you had it in Muslim hands, then it went to the Crusaders' hands, then it goes to the Turkish hands. Eventually, in the 19th century, it's going to fall into the hands of Napoleon Bonaparte. It goes into that area. It's fought over again. After World War I, it goes into the hands of the British. Okay? And that's where it is, from the end of World War I until 1947, when the State of Israel is created. And those of you who are alive at that time or later know the rest of that story. It has been a series of wars ever since between the Israelites and the Palestinians, fighting over this land. Another little thing that we have there. The most precious place for the Jewish people is the spot where the temple once stood. Okay? On the spot where the temple once stood, which is the place where it was believed that Abraham had sacrificed, we would say Isaac, they would say Ishmael. So you got two, and the stone itself, how it went from there to Saudi Arabia, I don't know. But anyway, that's the spot. And it's also the place where Muhammad supposedly had a vision of God and ascended up into heaven. Okay? Long story short, this big, beautiful mosque that you see when you see pictures of Jerusalem with the big gold dome and everything else, the Dome of the Rock, right? That's Muslim. That's built on the spot where the temple once was. What the Jews would love to do is to raise that to the ground and rebuild the temple. That happens, that's when World War III is going to start, okay? And it's all about that. It's all about that. Now, we as Christians could stand in the background and say, but none of that makes any sense. Why? Because Jesus, we would say, is the fulfillment of all of this, right? You don't need the mosque or the temple. What you do need is that big church that we have, the Holy Sepulchre. That's the important part, okay? Where the crucifixion and the resurrection takes place. But this is the kind of the heart of the whole matter. Now, it didn't matter for a long time because basically Islamic countries were very poor. Didn't have a whole lot going for them. Until they discovered oil. And that's when things began to really escalate, because now they had money, and with money comes power, and they want to exercise that power. So now you know kind of the rest of that story and why things are as they are today. So, just in case I missed something or something wasn't clear, are there any questions about that? Is this all pretty clear to everybody? Okay.
Father, the only question I had was, what is, you might have said it, what does the word Quran mean?
A recitation, a reciting, right. Now, well, he would claim that, you know. He never did, as far as I know, but certainly Muslims later on would say that as an Arab, he would be a descendant of Hagar and Ishmael. Yeah. Muhammad never wrote anything down himself. He received his revelations, and then he would dictate these, and he had other people kind of compiling everything together. But he never gave any background in history. It was just basically, this is just the pure word of God as revealed to me by the angel Gabriel. This is all that we have. But he never gave any commentary. Any other thoughts or questions? Okay. Well, so what did Muhammad receive from the Old Testament? Obviously, he received the words of the prophets, and he knew what the prophets were going to say. He heard about the Gospels and about the teachings of Jesus. And here's another interesting thing. There's actually more written in the Quran about Mary than there is in the Bible. Believe it or not. He saw a lot of these people from the scriptures as being true people who gave themselves completely to God, that they were complete Muslims and thought they were great examples. He said that the mistake that we as Christians made was that we made Jesus the Son of God. He says, God forbid that Christ, you know, Allah would have a son. That's just not possible. But that Jesus was a great prophet. Now, what he got from the Christian heretics was this. We know that Jesus dies upon the cross. There were a sect of early heretics called the Docetists. The Docetists did not believe that Jesus had a physical body, just the appearance of a body, because he was God, and he would not assume a human body. Therefore, it was not Jesus who died upon the cross, but somebody else who died in his stead, while Jesus kind of did his own thing and went up to heaven after that. Okay? Now, I'm not kidding. This is an actual Christian heresy. And the church said, well, of course not. Because as St. Paul says, if Christ was not crucified, what's the point? Let's just go home. And there's no reason for all this. But again, Muhammad would say, no, that it was not Jesus who died upon the cross. So this is how we know that he got his ideas from the wrong-thinking Christians, right? But he has lots about the Old Testament. He mentions the names of the patriarchs and the prophets, and many of their teachings are in the Quran. Many of the teachings of Christ from the Gospels are here, and of the apostles. Some of the things that are most important to us, like the sacrifice of Christ, the Eucharist, and those kinds of things, are not in there. He basically just includes the moral teachings of the Gospels, right? And how people show their devotion to God that way. But of course, that he himself would be the last of the prophets. But what did he know in the desert? After Christianity became legalized in the year 315 by the Roman Emperor Constantine, eventually, after time, it would become the official religion of the Roman Empire. The problem with that is you had lots of people now becoming Christian because it was fashionable. So lots of people, like today, were Christian in name only, but certainly not in practice. And a lot of Christians longed for the days when you would actually be martyred for practicing your faith. And they thought that Christianity was something worth dying for, not just faking it, right? So following the example of not just St. Anthony of Egypt, but many others, they decided to voluntarily martyr themselves in a way, not by blood, but by sacrifice of their lives. They would withdraw to the desert, and imitating Jesus, would give up marriage, would live in obedience to a superior, and live in poverty and in work and in prayer all the days of their lives. This is the beginning of monasticism. Monos in Greek means one who is alone, alone with God, out in the desert. This is the beginning of religious life, by the way. Eventually, these groups of solitary hermits and hermitesses, yet men and women both who did this, would be gathered together into communities under a leader, an abbot or an abbess, right? And that's the beginning of monastic life as we know it today. But in its most primitive form, you had these solitaries in the desert, and they would pray five times a day, sometimes seven times a day. They woke up in the middle of the night to pray the Psalms, right? And they would usually face toward Jerusalem, right? As the Psalm says, if I forget you, Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. So this is what they did, right? And Muhammad does the very same thing. He has Muslims praying five times a day in imitation of what he saw the monks doing, as we heard in the Quran that he really had a favor toward, doing the same thing. Another ancient monastic practice is what we call in Latin lectio divina, right? Which means a study of the sacred scriptures. Now, what you don't know is that a lot of times monks who couldn't read would listen to somebody else and they would recite what they heard, okay? What we would call kind of murmuring wisdom. So they hear somebody else and they would just repeat it to themselves over and over again to memorize it. What does Quran mean in English? Recitation, okay? What do Muslims do today? They pore over this book, okay? They study it inside and out, in the original language, too, by the way, in classical Arabic. It's a beautiful book, written very beautifully and poetically, by the way, just to kind of let you know. So I'm not going to say that Muhammad was an evil person, right? He may have had a very good intention. He's probably a very well-educated man, or at least a very intelligent man, to put this together, and I think he had good intentions. But like with everything else, those good intentions can go awry when somebody with bad intentions uses it for something evil. Okay? And this is where we're going to see the split between the Sunni Muslims and the Shiite Muslims eventually, following different caliphs. Stay with me so far? Let's go back to our glossary of terms. In the glossary of terms under Shiite and Shia, and Sunni, under the S's, a Shiite is one of the two major groups in Islam, comprising approximately 20% of Muslims worldwide. Shiites believe that Ali, the cousin and son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, was designated as Muhammad's successor. Okay, that didn't mean a whole lot, but what they are saying is they believe in a more primitive understanding and very strict interpretation of Islam. Okay? Those are the people causing the trouble that we have in the world, the trouble in the world today. The Sunnis are the majority group of Islam, comprising about 80% of Muslims worldwide. Sunnis believe that the Prophet's best friend, Abu Bakr, was selected by consensus of the majority to succeed him. Again, that doesn't mean a whole lot to us, but it does in the world of Islam. It's two philosophical understandings of Islam. Why can we not say that it's a division or a sect? For several reasons. First of all, there is no hierarchy in Islam. Unlike in Catholicism, there's no pope. Okay? There are no bishops. There are no priests or pastors. You have scholars, pretty much like in the Jewish faith, you have the rabbis. All right? And so you have these different divisions of Judaism depending on how strictly you want to interpret the Torah or the law. You go from Orthodox to Conservative to Reform in Judaism. In Islam, you have Sunni and you have Shiite. Just like in the Jews, in the Orthodox sphere, you have a group of people called the Hasidim. Those are the people with the long black coats and the long beards and the little curls that you see. Okay? They follow a very devotional, a very emotional understanding and prayer life of the Jewish faith. You will find that called Sufism, all right, in Islam. So within the Shiite, within the Sunni movement, you're going to see various ways of devotion. There's mysticism. There's certain things like the, you've heard of the whirling dervishes before, the Turkish whirling dervishes. That's kind of a part of the whole Sufi movement. So things like that. The Shiites would basically be what we would call fundamentalists today in Christianity, right? Going back to very basic, pure, primitive understanding of Islam the way that the Prophet himself would have wanted it. And these are the ones that are looking to impose Sharia law, which if you look before that, it's Islamic law based on the Quran and the sayings and the actions of the Prophet Muhammad. Okay? But a very strict understanding and interpretation thereof. So that kind of gives you a basic background on Muhammad, the world that he came from, and some of the influence that Islam has in the lives of its believers. But let's talk about the actual tenets of Islam. If you go to the beliefs and daily lives of Muslims, we're going to go through the six major beliefs. So basically today, if you were to ask me, all right, Father, what do Muslims believe? Here we have it in a nutshell. They believe in the oneness of God. There's only one God. Muslims believe that God is the creator of all things and that God is all-powerful and all-knowing. God has no offspring, no race, no gender, no body. He is unaffected by the characteristics of human life. This is probably one of the basic differences between Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, in that there's the understanding that God is completely outside of the human experience. Okay, God is completely other. In Judaism, however, God takes the initiative to actually talk to his people. He will reveal himself, okay, to prophets. He will even reveal himself to an individual, right? Not so in Islam. God did not speak to Muhammad. The angel Gabriel did. Okay? So there's a messenger that came from God, not God directly, but this is the angel comes with the word of God. For Christianity, we believe that God himself comes among us, that God assumes our full humanity, right, and has a human experience. Therefore, we had that intimate connection with God that you won't find in Islam, not quite so much in Judaism, but certainly not in Islam at all. But you have the oneness of God. Secondly, belief in the angels of God. Muslims believe in angels just as we do. Unseen beings who worship God and carry out God's orders through the universe. And the angel Gabriel brought the divine revelations to the prophets. Then we have belief in the books of God. Muslims believe that God revealed holy books of scriptures to a number of God's messengers. And these include the Quran given to Muhammad, the Torah or the law given to Moses, and the gospel given to Jesus, the Psalms given to David, the scrolls given to Abraham. Muslims believe, however, that these earlier scriptures in their original form were divinely revealed, but that only the Quran remains as it was first revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, so that the Quran surpasses all the others. Next, belief in the prophets or the messengers of God. Muslims believe that God's guidance has been revealed to mankind through specifically appointed messengers or prophets throughout history, beginning with Adam, the first man, who is considered the first prophet. 25 of these prophets are mentioned by name in the Quran, including Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. Muslims believe that Muhammad is the last in this line of prophets sent for all humankind with the message of Islam. Muslims also believe in the Day of Judgment. They believe that on the Day of Judgment, humans will be judged for their actions in this life. Those who followed God's guidance will be rewarded with paradise, and those who rejected God's guidance will be punished with hell. And lastly, the belief in the divine decree. That's the article of faith that we just talked about. That there's only one God who is Allah, Muhammad is the prophet of God. This addresses the question of God's will. It can be expressed as the belief that everything is governed by God's divine decree, namely that whatever happens in one's life is preordained and that believers should respond to the good or bad that befalls them with thankfulness and patience. This concept does not negate the concept of a free will. Since humans don't have prior knowledge of God's decree, they do have a freedom of choice, but that God wills everything. Now, these are the most important points of Islam, the five pillars or the five acts of worship that you will find in Islam. First is the declaration of faith, the Shahada. The first act of worship is the declaration that there is no deity except God and Muhammad is the messenger of God. Muslims repeat this statement many times a day during their prayers. If someone wants to become a Muslim, he or she simply makes this profession of faith as an entry into Islam. Next is prayer. Islam prescribes a brief prayer or ritual worship five times a day, at dawn, noon, late afternoon, sunset, and night. Muslims perform ablutions before prayer. This, by the way, is an ancient Jewish practice, and it kind of fell out of practice in Christianity as it moved into the West, but we kind of kept a small bit of it. What do y'all do when you first come to the church? Make a sign on the cross with holy water, all right? So Muslims perform this ablution before prayer, a brief prescribed washing of the hands, mouth, nose, face, arms, and feet. One may pray alone or in a group in any clean location, including a mosque. The Friday noon prayer is special to Muslims and is done in a mosque if possible. Muslims face in the direction of Mecca when they pray. Third, charity. In Arabic, zakat. Muslims are required to give to the poor and needy. Islam prescribes an obligatory charity known as zakat based on 2.5% of one's income and wealth. In addition to this prescribed charity, Muslims are encouraged to give as much as they can in voluntary charity throughout the year. Fasting. Muslims are required to fast from dawn to sunset during the month of Ramadan, that is the ninth month of their lunar calendar. We follow a solar calendar, they follow one that's guided by the moon. People gather in the evenings, though, for a festive breaking of the fast. When fasting, Muslims refrain from food, liquid, and sexual activity. During Ramadan, Muslims are also supposed to abstain from negative behaviors, such as lying, gossip, petty arguments, and negative thoughts or behaviors, including getting angry. Muslims are required to start fasting when they reach puberty, although some younger children may also fast. People who are sick, traveling, menstruating, and pregnant or nursing may break their fast, but may make up the days later in the year. The elderly and people with disabilities are excused from fasting. Ramadan was the month in which the revelation of the Quran to Muhammad began. Therefore, Muslims are encouraged to read the Quran during this month and often gather in the evenings in mosques to listen to recitations from the Quran. Then there's a feast after that, the festival of fast-breaking, Eid al-Fitr. This is one of the major Muslim holidays and celebrates the completion of the Ramadan fast and occurs on the first day of the month after Ramadan. This is a day of celebration, prayers, feasts, and gift-giving. Pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. Every Muslim is required to make the pilgrimage to Mecca, located in Saudi Arabia, once in their lifetime if financially and physically able. Mecca is the home to the first house of worship of God, the Kaaba, said to have been built by the prophet Abraham and his son Ishmael. Muslims all over the world face towards the Kaaba when they pray. All outward symbols of rank and wealth are erased during the pilgrimage as Muslims from every part of the globe come together for the purpose of worshiping God. They even don a special robe, just a plain white robe that they wear. Muslims who complete the pilgrimage are referred to as the Haji and are greeted with great celebration and respect in their communities when they return. At the end of a pilgrimage, or there's a festival of sacrifice. It's the second major holiday in Islam. It falls on the 10th day of the month at the conclusion of the pilgrimage and is celebrated by all Muslims with special prayers, feasts, gifts, and the sacrifice of an animal, usually a lamb or a goat, and the meat is then given to relatives, friends, and the needy. So there you have your five pillars, or the five practices upon which Islam rests. Briefly, we'll go over their daily life. Okay. Islam contains many rules for daily life and human relationships. The first source of these rules is the Quran, and the second is the Hadith, or reports of the Prophet's words and actions passed on, what we would call sacred tradition. This is Hadith to them, passed on by his followers. Prohibitions. In Islam, everything considered harmful, either to the body, mind, or soul, or society, is prohibited. It's called haram. While whatever is beneficial or permissible is permissible, called halal. Islam prohibits Muslims from consuming pork, alcohol, or mind-altering drugs. Muslims are required to eat meat that is butchered and blessed in an Islamic way. And this meat is called halal. This they get from the Jewish faith and what's called kosher. That means fit to eat. Muslims are also prohibited from gambling, taking interest, fortune-telling, killing, lying, stealing, cheating, oppressing, or abusing others, being greedy or stingy, engaging in sex outside of marriage, disrespecting parents, and mistreating relatives, orphans, or neighbors. Role of the clergy. As I said, there is no hierarchy or clergy of clergy in Islam, nor do Muslim religious leaders have the power to forgive people of their sins. Every individual has a direct relationship with God without any intermediary. There are religious leaders or scholars called ulema, or imams, who have studied and are experts in the different aspects of Islam, such as Sharia, Hadith, or Quranic recitation. It is also important to note that there is not one Islamic authority, so there are differences among Muslim scholars. Conversion to Islam. Muslims are encouraged to share their faith with others. However, Muslims are told not to attack others' beliefs or engage in conflicts or debates about matters of religion. There is no formal ceremony for conversion. People must simply or merely believe in and recite the Shahada to convert to Islam. Now, one word that was left out of here, but you'll find in your glossary, though, and it's the hot word for modern times, is jihad. Okay? We have come to understand jihad as holy war, but the Arabic word means striving in the way of God. We would call that in Christianity spiritual warfare, okay? To be at battle with one's own inner demons, so that one can be more like Christ. For them, it's more like God. The Arabic word, jihad, meaning striving in the way of God. And this striving can take a number of forms, the most common of which is the daily inner struggle to be a better person. But it can also be armed jihad, which is permitted in defense of Islam if there's something that will harm or destroy or threaten Islam itself. Okay? So this is how we get that term being used in jihad. All right. I'm not going to go over the role of women in Islam. That you can study yourself, just for the sake of time. Because I did want to go through something else. If you heard my homily this past Sunday, as I said, we can sometimes be a little bit of a negative people about things. And that's kind of true of the world in general and of the news media. But Christianity is a religion of hope. So while there's a lot of fear about what may happen in Islam, and maybe that there might be some reason for fear, I also said that we have to have reason for hope, because we as Christians believe that God is greater than all things, that Christ is greater than all things. So I'd like for you all to turn to the very last three pages that I have here, well, the last page and a half, really. Something that was written by Archbishop Fulton Sheen, and this is from his book, The World's First Love, about Mary. Mary is for Muslims the true Sayyida, or the true lady. The only possible serious rival to her in their creed would be Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad himself. Strike anything in you? Mm-hmm. But after the death of Fatima, Muhammad wrote, "Thou shalt be the most blessed of all the women in paradise after Mary." In a variant of the text, Fatima is made to say, "I surpass all the women except Mary." Now he's going to use the old word. I'm going to be more politically correct and say Islam instead of Muslimism. Okay? Islam is the only great post-Christian religion of the world. Because it has its origin in the 7th century under Muhammad, it was possible to unite within it some elements of Christianity and of Judaism, along with particular customs of Arabia. Islam takes the doctrine of the unity of God, His majesty and His creative power, and uses it in part as a basis for the repudiation of Christ, the Son of God. Misunderstanding the notion of the Trinity, Muhammad made Christ a prophet, announcing Him just as to Christians, Isaiah and John the Baptist are prophets announcing the Christ. The Christian European West barely escaped destruction at the hands of the Muslims. At one point, they were stopped near Tours at the Battle of Poitiers, I told you about with Charles Martel, and at another point later on in time outside the gates of Vienna, and of course at the Battle of Lepanto, that's something else that's different. The church throughout northern Africa was practically destroyed by Muslim power, and at the present hour, Muslims are beginning to rise again. If Islam is a heresy, which means a false Christian teaching, which it could be thought of that way, as Hilaire Belloc, who was a great English writer, believes it to be, then it's the only heresy that never declined. Others have had a moment of vigor and have gone into doctrinal decay, the death of the leader, and finally evaporated in a vague social movement. Islam, on the contrary, has only had its first phase. There never was a time in which it declined, either in numbers or in the devotion of its followers. The missionary effort of the church toward this group has been, at least on the surface, a failure, for the Muslims are so far almost unconvertible. The reason is that for a follower of Muhammad to become a Christian is much like a Christian becoming a Jew, like a step backwards. Muslims believe that they have the final and definitive revelation of God to the world, and that Christ was only a prophet announcing Muhammad, the last of God's real prophets. At the present time, the hatred of Muslim countries against the West is becoming a hatred against Christianity itself, and we've seen that. And like I said, we in the West are being taught to generalize and say that all Muslims are horrible, okay? But that's not the case. As is true in anything at all, we can't generalize. We have to deal with individuals on an individual basis, okay? Not every Muslim hates Christians, okay? At the same time, not every Christian hates Muslims, nor should we. In fact, we're supposed to be the religion of love, establishing peace, and sometimes we're not. As I said, when we live anyway except with like Christ, that's when we cause problems. So although the statesmen, that is our politicians, have not yet taken it into account, there is still a grave danger that the temporal power of Islam may well return, and with it, the menace that it may shake off a West which has ceased to be Christian and affirm itself as the great anti-Christian world power. Muslim writers say, when the locust swarms darken vast countries, they bear on their wings these Arabic words, "We are God's host. Each of us has 99 eggs, and if we had 100, we should lay waste the world and all that is in it." So remember that it is a religion that conquers, okay? Remember that Muhammad wanted to unite these warring nations, and they began to spread by warfare, all right? That's in its origin. It is our firm belief, well, the problem is, how should we prevent the hatching of the 100th egg? It is our firm belief that the fears some entertain concerning the Muslims are not to be realized, but that Islam itself will eventually be converted to Christianity, and in a way that some of our missionaries never suspect. It is our belief that this will happen not through the direct teaching of Christianity, but through a summoning of the Muslims to a veneration of the Mother of God. And this is the line of argument. The Quran, which is the Bible of the Muslims, has many passages concerning the Blessed Virgin. First of all, I'm missing a page, it seems. On the second page, what, how does it begin for y'all? That's helpful. The Quran, kind of embarrassed, I'm the one that told her to do that too. The Quran believes in her Immaculate Conception and also in her virgin birth. The third chapter of the Quran places the history of Mary's family in a genealogy which goes back through Abraham, Noah, and Adam. When one compares the Quran's description of the birth of Mary with the apocryphal gospel, that is the Gospel of Thomas, of the birth of Mary, one's tempted to believe that Muhammad very much depended on that, which I think he did, okay, on a false gospel that tells the story of St. Anne and St. Joachim and the conception of Mary. Both books describe the old age and the definite sterility of the mother of Mary. When, however, she conceives, the mother of Mary is made to say in the Quran, O Lord, I vow and I consecrate to you what is already within me. Accept it from me. When Mary is born, her mother says, And I consecrate her with all her posterity under thy protection, O Lord, against Satan. The Quran passes over Joseph in the life of Mary, but Muslim tradition knows his name and has some familiarity with him. In this tradition, Joseph is made to speak to Mary, who is a virgin. As he inquired how she conceived Jesus without a father, interestingly enough, they don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God, but they believe that he was divinely conceived, without a human father. So figure that one. And Mary answered, Do you not know that God, when he created the wheat, had no need of seed, and that God, by his power, made the trees grow without the help of rain? All that God had to do was say, So be it, and it was done. The Quran also has verses on the Annunciation, the Visitation, and the Nativity. Angels are pictured as accompanying the Blessed Mother and saying, O Mary, God has chosen you and purified you and elected you above all the women of the earth. In the 19th chapter of the Quran, there are 41 verses on Jesus and Mary. There is such a strong defense of the virginity of Mary here that the Quran in the fourth book attributes the condemnation of the Jews to their monstrous calumny against the Virgin Mary. Hate to say that, but that is true. In the Talmud, there are some horrible things that are said about the Virgin Mary and the conception of Christ, that she was actually like a prostitute, and that Jesus was not who he said he is. Okay? Mary, then, for the Muslims, is the true... The Talmud, by the way, is just a book of commentaries by ancient rabbis on the Jewish scriptures. Mary, then, is for the Muslims the true Sayyida, or Lady. The only possible serious rival to her in their creed would be Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad himself. But after the death of Fatima, Muhammad wrote, Thou shalt be, as I said, the most blessed of all women in paradise after Mary. In a variant of the text, she says, I surpass all women except Mary. Which brings us to a second point. Why the Blessed Mother, in this 20th century, 1917, should have revealed herself in the insignificant little village in Portugal, once dominated by Muslims, called Fatima, so that all future generations would know her as Our Lady of Fatima. And what did Our Lady of Fatima tell us to do? To pray the what?
Rosary.
Excellent. Since nothing ever happens out of heaven except with the finesse of all details, I do believe that the Blessed Virgin chose to be known as Our Lady of Fatima as a pledge and a sign of hope that to the Muslim people and as an assurance that they who show her so much respect will one day accept her divine son too. God bless you. Evidence to support these views is found in the historical fact that the Muslims occupied Portugal for centuries. At the time when they were finally driven out, the last Muslim chief had a beautiful daughter by the name of Fatima himself. A Catholic boy fell in love with her, so the legend goes. And for him, she not only stayed behind when the Muslims left, but she even embraced his faith. The young husband was so much in love with her that he changed the name of the town where he lived to Fatima. Thus, the very place where Our Lady appeared in 1917 bears a historical connection to Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad. The final evidence of the relationship of Fatima to the Muslims is the enthusiastic reception which the Muslims in Africa and India and elsewhere give to the pilgrim statue of Our Lady of Fatima, as mentioned earlier. Muslims attend the church services in honor of Our Lady. They allowed religious processions and even prayers before their mosques, and in Mozambique, the Muslims who were unconverted began to be Christian as soon as the statue of Our Lady of Fatima was erected. Therefore, missionaries in the future will more and more see that their apostolate among the Muslims will be successful in the measure that they preach Our Lady of Fatima. Mary is the advent of Christ, bringing Christ to the people before Christ himself is born. In any apologetic endeavor, it's always best to start with that which people already accept. Because the Muslims have a devotion to Mary, our missionaries should be satisfied merely to expand and to develop that devotion, with the full realization that our Blessed Lady will carry the Muslims the rest of the way to her divine Son. but she is forever a traitor. A traitor in the sense that she will not accept any devotion for herself, but will always bring anyone who is devoted to her to her divine son. As those who lose devotion to her lose belief in the divinity of Christ, so those who intensify devotion to her gradually will acquire that belief in the divinity of Christ. Many of our great missionaries in Africa have already broken down the bitter hatred and prejudices of the Muslims against the Christians through their acts of charity, through their schools and their hospitals. It now remains to use another approach, namely that of taking the 41st chapter of the Quran and showing them that it was taken out of the Gospel of Luke, which is basically true. That Mary could not be, even in their own eyes, the most blessed of all the women of heaven if she had not also borne the one who is the Savior of the world. If Judith and Esther of the Old Testament were prefigures of Mary, then it may well be that Fatima herself was a postfigure of Mary. The Muslims should be prepared to acknowledge that if Fatima must give way in honor to the Blessed Mother, it is because she is different from all of the mothers of the world, and that without Christ she would be nothing. And I will conclude with this. This is from another talk that I was giving. I was doing some research and I found something that's not really publicized but should be. But this was an interview that was done with a North African imam, that is a Muslim cleric. The great concern in Africa right now, in sub-Saharan, southern Africa, is that before probably the middle of the century, hope, please God, it would happen, there could be a Christian majority in Africa. Right now, that is, while Christianity is dying in Europe, almost dead, and certainly starting to die in the United States and even Latin America, it's thriving in Africa. And that's the fear, is that Christianity is going to outnumber Muslims in Africa before too long. And it was interesting because this was actually televised on Al Jazeera Network. So you can YouTube that if you want. I forget the whole title of it, but basically it's, you know, Muslim cleric talking about conversions in Africa that will cause Christianity to actually overcome the African continent, which would be very interesting because prior to Muhammad, as I told you, North Africa, Ethiopia, Eastern Africa, you had a thriving Christian civilization that was decimated. We may see it come back again one day. We already have African priests who are coming to evangelize us here, don't we? So it's a sign, I think, of things to come. But we must pray, as Mary said, and pray fervently that this can certainly come to pass. All right. With that, I'll have a closing prayer and a blessing. And if those want to stay for questions, want to do so, please do.